Test, 1, 2, 3.
Testing, 1, 2, 3. Testing, 1, 2, 3. November 14th, 2007. My interview with Rear Admiral Ken Summers on the Gulf War and the Navy perspective. So, when did you join the Army?
Join the Navy?
I mean the Navy, excuse me, the Navy.
Well, I went to, I graduated high school in Ottawa in 63, and I went up to Royal Roads Military College in September of 63 as a naval cadet.
What was the reason for joining the Navy?
At the time, basically, it was education. I knew very, very little about the military, almost nothing, to be exact. But it was to get a good education. And my father had been a chief in the Navy, and he always had admired the military colleges and what they had were able to achieve with people. And so he was very instrumental in steering me that way. That's how I ended up going to military college.
What were you trained in? Did you trade?
Well, it's not a trade. It says during my junior officer training, I spent 2 years at Royal Roads, and then at that time you had to go to RMC in Kingston for your final 2 years. I started out in engineering because I had quite high marks coming out of Ontario, but I realized that I hadn't read a book in 2 years at Royal Roads. Essentially, I used to read quite a bit, and so I was able to switch over to political science and history, economics for my final 2 years. I still have all the credits, so I graduated with Bachelor of Arts in political science.
What was the training realistic from what you encountered at sea?
Well, I should mention after graduation from military college, you go through junior officer type training, and most of that was done on the West Coast, and you learned all the good things about navigation, seamanship, and all that basic stuff that every naval officer going to sea has to know. And at that time, the training squadron on the West Coast here was very, very good at giving young officers the time to experience days at sea and learn the profession. And so I would say that certainly from the basics in the first few years out in the West Coast, that training was excellent and the basics. 72 was really a defining moment in the training where you then start to specialize. Up to that point, I did all the seamanship stuff. I was an air controller. I had done navigation, this type of thing here. But in 72, I went on what was called a long operations course, which was an operations specialty. So it basically, all the operations and running an operations room in a warship is something that was a specialty. And that's what, in fact, I undertook in 1972 to 73. 71, 72, sorry, and then very fortunate to, on graduation from that, in the summer of 72, to be appointed to the commissioning crew of HMCS Iroquois, which was the first of the DDH-280 class ships, which were the sisters of the space age, computer systems up to yin-yang, and it was the best that the Navy's had in the world, I guess, and those 280s really were very important in understanding command and control and how you exercise forces at sea. The 280 also was a command ship, and it taught me and others how to command and control a task group of ships, where you would have a number of ships that the 280 controlled or coordinated all the operations of. And that type of understanding of command and control was something that, again, paid dividends downstream in some of those later operations. So the training that was underway was, I think, quite realistic at sea.
Was there a mentor or leader in the Navy which you followed?
Yeah, well, there was many. I mean, I think anyone who's gone through has people that really mentored you. In the early days, there was a crusty old lieutenant commander by the name of Art Rouse, who basically taught me it was fun to be at sea.
Rouse,
R-O-W-S-E. He's here in Victoria, but he taught me it was fun to be at sea, and I learned an awful lot from him from that aspect of it. Certainly when I got on to the captain, Jim Cumming, retired as a Commodore, again out here, he was a great first commanding officer and had an awful lot of time for junior officers and helping them develop their skills. And so he gave you all sorts of opportunities that allowed you to do things that perhaps or beyond, or pushing your capabilities so that you learn that type of thing and were developing. With the 280s, commander, and then eventually Commodore Doc McGilvery was the first CEO of HMC as Iroquois. A tremendous gentleman, and backed a number of people on that particular ship, including someone by the name of John Anderson, who was also an operations officer. He went on to be full admiral and chief of defense staff. And John was certainly a mentor during that period of time. Later on, I guess, as I got into more of the, I say bureaucracy, but that's not quite right, but into operations at the National Defense Headquarters and some of the policy side of things and requirements, developing the new ships, for example, and actively involved in the frigate program, which is the new ships, the most recent capable warships. There was an individual by the name of Chuck Thomas, Vice Admiral Chuck Thomas, who again here is in Victoria, that in fact was very important in terms of mentoring me, Nigel Berdur, Admiral Berdur, who was also here. Again, was another mentor that taught me an awful lot about being in the Navy. So there's no shortage of people that gave me enough rope to hang myself, and fortunately I did not do that. And one other I should mention was, over the years, was General John Nashasin, who was Chief of Defense Staff during the Gulf War. And then when I subsequently was appointed down to Commander at Defense Liaison Staff at the Embassy in Washington, General DeShasson was now Mr. DeShasson as the ambassador down there in Washington. And then he then came back to see us. So those are some of the people. There was no shortage of mentors, as I mentioned, in my training.
Before the Gulf War, how many years prior to the Gulf War had you been in the Navy? And what was your rank when the war had just started?
I guess it would have been, I graduated in 67, and so 89 or 90, 91, so you're talking about 23 years. I'd actually been in the Navy. I was a Commodore at the time down in Halifax, and my position there was Chief of Staff Operations for the Admiral, the headquarters there, but also Commander of Canadian Fleet, which meant I was the senior going to sea naval officer on the East Coast at the time for all of the ships on the East Coast Fleet.
At the time, did you believe the role that Canada was given or had taken was too much or too little?
You say Canada, so I'm talking, you're assuming the big picture. I would mention that when the Gulf War started, the invasion took place, I think it was the 2nd of August, or something around there, 2nd of August. Very quickly, the Canadian ambassador to the United Nations was quite involved in discussions in the United Nations. He was supported and seconded, spoke out on a number of the resolutions condemning the actions of Saddam Hussein and the Iraqi attack and invasion of Kuwait. And I thought at the time this was quite appropriate. I've often said, the wall had fallen in Germany, and peace was supposedly breaking out all over the place, and everyone was trying to spend the peace dividend. And all of a sudden, in that one summer, we had the OCA crisis here, which totally bought up the focus of Canadians. So we're all looking internally within the country, and the army was heavily committed in the OCA, conflict, the OCA crisis. And try to sort out what did that really mean, because this was quite a challenge to Canada. And then all of a sudden, the other side of the world, this thing happens in Kuwait, and people say, oh, gee, what's going on? Oh, what's happening here? And I think the chorus of condemnation that was heard in the United Nations and by the nations was rather appropriate. I was aware as well that there had been discussions between the Prime Minister, who was Brian Mulroney, and George Bush Sr. down in the States on what might be the results. I was aware of all that. So I guess things were proceeding apace, and the one thing you do in the military is you always plan. So without anybody telling you, hey, do this. well, actually, I was told, I suppose, by my people in Ottawa, saying, hey, we better think ahead. And there was guys like John Anderson and Chuck Thomas that in fact said, what do we got down there? Ken, start, what have you got to in case you get called? And we end up looking around, and we were preparing for a major NATO exercise up off the North Sea, and I had four ships that were being ready for that particular operation, so they quickly became the focus of my concern, my planning in terms of what might be available. When the decision came down that Canada would get involved, and I believe that was around the 8th of August, if the member serves me right, we had a bit of a green light that we were going to get involved in this. And I remember there was a briefing after the Prime Minister announced it in our headquarters down in Halifax, and there was a map of the area. And I remember one of the questions being asked, where are you going to operate over there? We had no idea. And I remember just sort of pointing broadly to the area outside the Persian Gulf, and it just hadn't been determined. But our focus that time, for the next couple of days, time we sailed, was daily, 24 hours a day, essentially on how do we take those ships, which were essentially built for operations in the North Atlantic, anti-submarine type warfare, and give them an anti-air capability and a surface capability that would allow them to conduct operations against the known threats in the Arabian Gulf. And that's what we did. And we had a daily meetings, which I chaired, of all of the senior staff and air staff in the Halifax area. And luckily, we had tribal class update program and the frigate programs underway, and equipments had been bought for those particular ships, but not installed, and the ships hadn't been built yet. So we were able to get those equipments from they were down in the States, companies there or in Canada, fly them into Halifax, and get them mounted on board the ships and make all the decks checked out and all that sort of stuff. And the same thing with the aircraft, some of the changes there that we would make. The only questions we really asked is of the staff at the time is, what do we need? Can we get the equipment? Can we actually get it down here? Can we fit it in time? Can we verify it's correct? And can we train our people in it prior to sailing in about 2 weeks' time from Halifax? And that's all that was required. The answers were yes on all of those, and we said, do it. And there was tremendous discretion at the junior levels of junior officers and people in the dockyard just to go and do things without having to wait for approval from on high, from whoever the poobah was that said, go ahead and do it. Those 2 weeks in Halifax were absolutely incredible. I said that the lights were on 24 hours a day. Dockyard workers continued to work almost nonstop, literally, until they fell asleep. Things were marked out on ships where they wanted their particular pieces of equipment to go, and the transformation that took place was just incredible. Aircraft landing, ships coming off, you know, equipment coming off, being brought over by truck to the dockyard, and all of a sudden, gee, where's that? That's a new piece of equipment on board the ship. So it was essentially a six-month refit of those ships, a normal six-month refit. To install those equipments was done in less than 2 weeks and checked out. I remember the Harpoon system in particular was went on Terra Nova, and this was a modern surface-to-surface missile. And we got that from the States. We had bought it for the frigate. And the field service representatives came up and they installed that on Terra Nova after taking out the old anti-submarine mortars. They put the Harpoon system in there. And they said it was the first time that they'd ever installed something like that and ran all the checks through, and everything was perfect. You know, it was I think it was a question of the focus was there, the drive was there, and the people were really wanted his job done and knew they had little times where have you done correct the first time around. So 2 weeks' time, we had general purpose ships with AAW capability installed, people trained in how to use it and maintain the equipment. I had the helicopters with new sensors on when they joined the ships, and we were able to do a quick little check off the coast for some of the equipment during that period of time, and then be prepared to sail when we did to go to the Gulf.
With all
That's a long answer for but it was an extremely intense period, and in fact, had it not occurred, it certainly would have shaped things at the building of our commitment and the Gulf during the time.
With all the new officers picked to go to the Arabian Sea, did you feel the more experienced officers should have gone instead?
Well, no. In fact, interestingly enough, when it first started, the decision of who was going to be in charge of it had not really been made. My responsibility was to get the ships ready, whether it was for a NATO exercise or that, and if it warranted, I would go to sea. I think in this case here, we were going into something that was completely unknown. We didn't know what we were really getting into. We didn't know where we were going to operate, quite honestly, at the time, over there someplace. We had three new commanding officers, although Doug McLean had been a previous commanding officer. We had a new, brand new squadron commander in Captain Miller. And it was decided at one stage of the game that at least that was proven, in fact, that I probably had the most experience and that I would go as commander of the group. There's another aspect of it, though, too, and that was that who would be the staff that would go. And there had been significant changes that particular summer in the squadron staff for the squadron that would normally have been doing the exercise in off Norway, North Sea. And given the nature of this one here, and given all the changes, I was permitted to choose whoever I wished for to be on the staff. And I spent a lot of time on that one there and thinking about that. And I chose people that were unconventional in their thinking, independent thinkers, ones that could think out of the box, because this was not going to be a cookie cutter type operation. We have never done this before, so I need people that could think outside the box. And to that extent, I was able to pick some absolutely superb officers to be the staff, and I got everybody except one individual who I wanted, but his loss if I'd taken him out of the Command and Staff College in Toronto, I had an impassioned plea from a good friend of mine, saying, please don't take him, I really need him, and so I left him. He was the only one I didn't take that I wanted. And I was able to get more than adequate replacement, second choice, if you want to call it that. But no, we had superb people, and Commander Forsyth, who you interviewed yesterday, was one of those people that I had the utmost confidence in. I had known J.Y. since he was a very junior officer, and so I very much wanted him to go with us. He was commanding officer of Algonquin at the time, one of the 280 class, but it was in refit and was going to be in there for over a year. So he was—he really was would have been available, and so I had him come as well. So I had—that's the type of staff that I took with me when we left, and away we went.
With such a staff that was outgoing and spoken, you didn't want people that would say yes, sir.
Yep.
Was there a lot of disagreement?
Well, there probably was. There were some robust discussions they had, probably I probably wasn't party to them all. Captain Miller, who was then essentially the chief of staff for the group, would have been the one that would have been more aware of that than I was. But I do recall one incident, and it was typical, but it was a good example of why we chose these type of people. And that occurred when on the way there in the Mediterranean, I went to that conference in Bahrain, where all the commanders were gathering, naval commanders, and at that time I did a talking to the other people, I made a mental appreciation myself that the place to operate was not outside the Arabian Gulf, but inside the Arabian Gulf, and more importantly, up in the middle to the northern end as opposed to the safer southern end, for all sorts of good reasons. And not the least of which was that we had proven our capability, the ships had proven themselves during extensive air attack, air planning in off of Gibraltar as we came across, and again with the French Air Force, back to the point where our people were very confident they could operate in any environment in the Gulf. So I came back with that appreciation and to the ship, and it was late in the evening, and it had been a long, long day, and I was very tired. So I gathered the staff there, and I said to them that I wanted to do an appreciation about where we should be operating. I told them both I had gone through it mentally and came to the conclusion that the best position for Canada, the best visibility for Canada, and the most the best role that Canada could play would have been in the middle Gulf, where there was problems getting nations up there, but we could do the job. I wanted to go through all the backings, and I gave a number of criteria to look at. And I remember one of the guys said to me, "You're crazy." And I said, "Just go ahead and do that appreciation. I'll see you first thing in the morning." And they went to bed. And the next morning, they had done their appreciation and did a superb one that night. In the morning, gathered them all again. And that particular officer said, "You're absolutely right. That's exactly where it should be." We finished off that appreciation, because this was brand new, sent it back to Admiral George in Halifax with our recommendation that we operate in the Central Gulf with the USN, and gave them all the reasons why, that particular paper, and I still have it. Admiral George looked at it, did his snake check on it, and said, "Yeah, I agree." Sent it up to headquarters in Ottawa, and within a matter of hours, we had an answer back saying, "You can commit to go to the Central Gulf." But there's a good example where staff, if I come back and say to the operator, "Yes, sir, you're crazy, you're crazy." But they did the check, and they did a very, very thorough check, and confirmed, I guess, the vast majority of the assumptions and the mental process that I've gone through. That was the value of having a staff that could do things like that. It would manifest itself when we were able to send people to on the staffs of other people. For example, during the actual conflict itself, when the Navy took on the role of responsibility for resupplying all the ships on the Gulf, the aircraft carriers, the battleships, the cruisers, and all that sort of stuff. That was a major evolution to make sure bullets, beams, food, bullets, beams, supplies of all sorts were able to come from those large tanker ships down the southern Gulf up to the actual combatants in the northern Gulf. That was a tremendous, tremendous logistics nightmare. Our staff, and we can get into that later on, how we ended up there, but the staff were able to do that. And one officer in particular, who happened to be the same guy that said, "You're crazy," I put him over on the flagship of the American carrier, and he essentially ran the whole thing himself. I mean, the Americans said, you got it, man, you can do it. Mm-hmm. And they were so confident in him, as I was in him, that they gave him free rein. And here was a Canadian commander on board an American carrier, writing off orders and messages out, directing ships to do all sorts of things, and he did it well.
It says a lot about our Navy and how we trained.
Well, it does. It does. Flexibility, yeah.
What were your thoughts of the Iraqi military? You said that you kind of had an idea where to put the Canadian Navy, but you must have looked at the Iraqi military.
Well, we did, and the major threat was the F-1 Mirage aircraft that the Iraqis had, with their Exocet missile, and so the air threat was something we were really concerned about. Mines was also another one we were very much concerned with, and to a certain extent, their missile patrol boats as well. On the training coming across, in the preparation, we worked extensively at that. I mentioned that we were completely confident what we were doing. Off at Gibraltar, I made a deal, an agreement with General Boyle, who was the head of the Air Force in Europe. And I said, okay, we will be in this box of water, which was, I can't recall, 100 miles by 100 miles or something like that, in the Atlantic, and we'll be there for 48 hours. You do your damnedest to make attacking on us. And so the F-18s, which were is better than, I think, the F-1 Mirages. And so we were there waiting for them, and taking all this information, coming in, picture compilation, exchanging information, ship's information. And when the attacks come in, you have to orient the ship such that the weapon arcs are open and you can engage them with the phalanx systems and the missile systems, the Sparrows, et cetera, et cetera. And quite honestly, during that period of time, and there was also thrown into that deception where an aircraft would come in that was a civilian aircraft, you know, so that you don't shoot down the aircraft like Vincennes occurred, you know, so that was, yeah. So all those, that type of training came in. By the end of that period, when they never did get a successful attack in, and when our own F-18s couldn't get an attack in on us, we knew, everyone on those ships knew, hey, we got it made. And it wasn't just, there were all sorts of systems on board the ships. I demanded of the CO that they had ironclad, I use that as a term, ironclad control over every weapon in his ship. And that came right down to the old Bofor guns and things like that that they had, came down to the Army personnel we had on board with the Javelin missile system that would engage aircraft coming in. And the COs were able to do that. They worked hard at it to the point where they had complete and absolute control over all their weapon systems at all times. And so the aircraft couldn't come in and get a good attack on us, and to a man on those ships, they knew they could handle anything that the Iraqi Air Force would throw at them. Now, what do we know about the Iraqi military? Well, they had large weapons from France in terms of the aircraft there. They also had a lot of Russian equipment. They were told to be 10 feet tall, but by the same token, talking with some of our allies, there was a question that was being raised that maybe, although they have the equipment, their training is not quite as good as perhaps is being made out to be. Mm-hmm. And that, in fact, over time, proved to be true. They didn't like flying at night. For example, they didn't like flying unless they had absolute positive control from a ground control center, let's put it that way. So they weren't as good as they really were. Having said that, they did have the Exocet missile, which is an excellent missile. And on our way over, after we did that, with the F-18s, the ship swung by, while I was at that conference, swung by France, and the variant of the Exocet missile that the Iraqis had, which came from France, the French Air Force and Navy were able to give us some significant operations there that allowed us to be superbly confident that from an electronic warfare point of view, that if there was a missile system out there, when they turned that thing on, we would know about it. All that, again, was the point that we were quite comfortable with where we need to operate. And really, that's all we had to know about the Iraqi threat. It was the F-1 Mirage, the patrol boats with their short-range missiles. That was something else that we knew about and had worked on over the years, so that one we were a bit more comfortable with. Mine warfare was something that was relatively new to us, and we had experts there. We had a mine avoidance sonar that was installed on the ships. And although that was brand new, we felt relatively confident that that would be able to help us when they had to go up north. Very concerned about things floating in the Persian Gulf, be it bags of garbage, which turned out to be most of the time, or perhaps a floating mine. Mm-hmm. So it was, we looked at all the threats, and we knew those were the threats that we had to concern ourselves with.
With the HMSC Fraser, and also with the training in the Mediterranean Sea, it gave you a lot of chances to see where your weaknesses were.
Yeah, I should have mentioned that. Fraser came along with us, and by God, she wanted to come with us all the way to the Gulf. But she was good to be orange and give us a good service-to-service training as well, and particularly with respect to Terra Nova with the Harpoon missile. was able to able to pick her up, and their CO a Fraser now, Jay Plant, and he was just outstanding, unconventional officer, and so he too provided a very good service, which allowed us to work on that. I should also mention that for the ship side in Gibraltar, we learned a fair amount of boarding operations from the Brits, and we saw how they did it, and the flag officer at Gibraltar set up an exercise in the Straits of Gibraltar, which are busier and heck with all sorts of contacts, to give us targets that we would be able to board and kind of do picture compilation, and which would be not unlike what we saw later in the Gulf with all these dhows and that coming going. So it was very good training that way. There was also, we went through the rest of the voyage into the most of the voyage into the to the actual Arabian Gulf with HMS Gloucester, and this was a British ship that was going over there, and they showed us a very nifty way, an excellent way of conducting a boarding operation using the helicopter, and it was superb. We tried that and did it quite successfully, and it was what happens is you get the vessel you're trying to board, and then one helicopter comes in and just makes an absolute nuisance of himself, buzzing this guy and making a real nuisance of himself. And so you get the whole people on the ship saying, "What the hell is that guy doing?" And they're all watching him, and what they don't see is the second helicopter coming with the crew, a repellent crew, and all of a sudden when they're looking this way, opposite side, there's a second helicopter, down they come on repelling ropes, and they're up on the bridge within 30 seconds and they've got control of the ship. An incredible capability. We tried that, we executed that with our people on board, and unfortunately we couldn't get clearance from the Air Force in Canada to let us do that, but I often thought that was in many ways one of the most effective way of taking a ship, as opposed to coming and having to climb up the ladder from the boats and taking control that way.
Before boarding, you would go to Halifax. A lot of the boarding was done on fishing boats. How did you change this policy of boarding and make it into more of an effective one for the Gulf?
Well, I think the boarding in Halifax, prior to that, had been on fishery patrol, which are rather benign. You'd be taking a fishery officer over this type of thing here. So it was a pretty benign environment. And other than the seamanship aspect of it, there wasn't too much, I guess, that went by comparison. When we went to the Gulf, we ended up taking a new boat, the RIB, inflatable boat. Rigid inflatable boat that was designed for the frigates, and we took them over to a much, much greater capability in rough weather and could take a larger crew. And so really we started developing the method of doing boarding, and to that extent we were aided in some of the procedures by the U.S. Coast Guard, who had been doing that for quite some time. And as I mentioned, the U.K., they had experience in this area. So we basically begged, borrowed, and stealed, and then, if you want to call it that, procedures, and then applied a Canadian stamp to it, and as we did a tremendous amount of the boarding operations, it became a Canadian process, and that has existed to this day, essentially. We refined that procedure through literally hundreds and hundreds of boardings that were there. And we also used helicopters for doing the monitoring, surveillance, and bringing this type of thing, as did Protector. Protector was very active in the boarding as well. So.
When looking at tactical plans from other forces and navies, what sense did you get out of the Gulf that had been the area, the region that you were in, since Canada has never been in the Gulf War before?
Well, sure, it was a brand new area to us, and even the environment, you don't until you've been there, you don't appreciate it. The Arabian Gulf, for its size, is a very shallow body of water, and so when the storms come through, it can whip up a pretty vicious chop and swell it if it's in there. When the sand blows, all of a sudden you find that even out in the middle of the ocean, you're your 72 almost whiteouts from sand coming across. So there was lots of things that we needed to learn from an environmental point of view. On the other hand, in terms of operating, there was not much of a problem this way in that we had, this is where all that NATO training paid off. You know, we're used to working with the other ships from almost all the navies, and even some of the ones that we had never worked with before that showed up. We would use basic NATO procedures. So we would give them unclassified version, if you want to call it that, of NATO maneuvering and ordering of positions and this type of thing here, and it worked extremely well. All those years of working together paid off. You know, I personally knew most of the commanders from the other navies. So did our COs. I mean, they worked with so-and-so exercise last year. Oh, yeah. Oh, great. So they knew one another, and they also, more importantly, knew each other's capabilities. So we were very comfortable with what we could expect from the American ships, what we could expect from the British ships, what we could expect from the French, the Spanish, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that was the dividend that came from NATO that came into play when that went in.
So you felt confident about the whole aspect of having the information on hand, and you knew everything. But there was no something that you didn't. There was no part where you wanted to have more information on.
In terms of how to do things?
Yeah, like just how to do things, yeah.
I don't think so. There was, again, things new in terms of the boarding aspect of it, but in terms of setting up areas to conduct surveillance and coordinate the operations of all the ships, I mean, that was something that we would do in exercises before, so there was nothing to do that way. What was, I think, new, and I don't know if we're going to get into that, but each nation came because it was not a NATO operation. It was a coalition of the willing that sent ships over there. Every ship, including our own, would come with national restrictions, mm-hmm. and which would be, in our case, you cannot operate north of so-and-so latitude. In some cases, some other nations had different regulations about what they could and could not do. And so it was prudent, as we got up doing a lot of the coordination there of the navies, to sit down with the commanders and have a one-on-one type thing. Okay, what can you do, what you can't do? Mm-hmm. And so that when you're trying to set up something that's going on, you know there's no point in asking him to do that because he can't do it. So when you give that task to this nation here, because you know that they can do it, and you can then do another task. So that type of coordination amongst the nations was something that took place, but it was you had it in the back of your mind national restrictions that each of them had and worked with that.
At the time, many countries really didn't know what.
That's no different than it is today in Afghanistan, by the way.
Oh, okay.
You know, for example, the Germans are not allowed to operate down south. Mm-hmm. They can only go down there in an emergency. Well, you know, Canada's down there. Each of the nations has their own national restrictions within NATO that is there. And the commanders in Afghanistan have to work within that.
With that, there's a lot of politics involved too, because you couldn't have a British Navy next to the Argentine Navy, could you? Or
well, in actual fact, that did occur. And it was a RFA, something leaf, a refueling ship, Bay Leaf. That in fact we in this resupply bit, because we were coordinated, we asked the Brit to resupply the Argentinian, and they did that. And I think this is where, in many cases, maybe politics takes a back seat to what has to be done at sea. Mm-hmm. You know, this is national politics are certainly there. But when you've got a task to be done and you're working as part of a joint group, sometimes those national politics gets put aside, if you will. And I don't think we've had no trouble at all in refueling the Argentinian.
At this time, did you know what Canada's stand was, what they wanted you to do, the policy? Because I know when you left Halifax, it was not really a clear-cut decision. Where
well, as no, there wasn't. But and yes, I was, because as the evolution of the whole conflict evolved, so too did the role that Canada would play, and not unlike me asking the government, here's where Canada should operate, and here's the reasons why, they in fact would come back and say, yeah, we agree, and oh, by the way, here's a national restriction, you're not not allowed to go above latitude, whatever the heck it is, and you're not allowed to engage in hostile operations, for example, without prior approval, because that stage hostilities had not occurred. So they didn't want Canadian settlers having a ship launch a missile at Iraq. You know, that was, so that's a part of national restrictions. But other than that, we had perhaps one of the most enabling sets of rules and engagement at that particular time that allow us to do just about anything within the Gulf in terms of being able to operate, conduct operations there. So,
do you get a proud sense?
I should just mention that the rules of engagement, as they call it, is something that was worked on daily type of thing. And if ever was an occasion, and there were, when I would see something happening on the air side or the naval side or even on the ground side with the hospital and the security unit, and I would ask back for permission to have a rule of engagement or relaxing a rule of engagement, that would then be worked on by the staff back in Ottawa. In some cases, they didn't have the legal permission to do that if they had to, or it was granted from the chief of defense staff, and then that would come back, and I'd tell, okay, you're now clear, you're able to do so and so. I can give you, I think this is one area that actually is terribly, I think it's terribly important on that, and it played out later on in the conflict. Canada, and this was the central staff in Ottawa, led by General de Chasselin and General Huddleston, who was deputy chief of defense staff, and Commodore Bruce Johnson. When I'd be talking to them on a daily basis, particularly Commodore Johnson, because he knew exactly what was going on over there at all times, you could see something developing. They would then go ahead to what was then called the War Cabinet. The War Cabinet was chaired by the Prime Minister and had the Minister of National Defense on and Foreign Affairs and a number of the key ministers. And they would brief them in advance, saying, okay, an example would have been the sweep and escort missions. If you walk into the Minister of National Defense and the Minister of Foreign Affairs, I want authorization to do sweep and escort missions, first thing he would say, what the hell is a sweep and escort mission? And so what happened was, in advance of this, they would go up, the team in Ottawa, and sort of, we've got a briefing today, ladies and gentlemen, on air operations and the potential sweep and escort. Here's what a sweep mission is, here's what an escort mission is, and you know, this may never come to pass, but downstream you may have to come to you and ask you permission to allow our aircraft to do those type of missions over Iraq or wherever, over Kuwait. And that prior briefing actually came to effect when things would develop and I would ask for that authority from the Gulf. Because it had already been briefed to the War Cabinet that the War Cabinet either already delegated that control back to the Chief of Defense Staff ahead of time and say, if and when he asks for that, you can give permission. Or if, in fact, it had not been given, when the Chief of Defense Staff said, I need permission now to do sweep and escort missions over Kuwait, I said, right, you got it. And quite often, I would receive an answer back in the Gulf on a rule of engagement that was done in a matter of hours. And many of the other nations said, how did you do that? Mm-hmm. How could you possibly do that? Because their systems were not as flexible and hadn't been refined. The military civilian interface with our government in that time there, I thought was absolutely superb. And that was due to the diligence of the people in headquarters that had that daily meeting with the War Cabinet and could sort of get them ahead of the curve and thinking before things actually happened.
What did you feel about the media? Do you think they portrayed the Gulf War fairly?
I think behind your particular question, you were talking about initially some a bit about, oh, you're sending old guns and this type of thing on, putting those on the ships. Well, in actual fact, we've gone through the process saying, hey, you know, we need those old guns because the very modern weapons that you have today, based on radar, when you fire that, they go to the center of the target. So if you've got a ship out there and you put your radar on that and you fire that gun, it's going to go to the center of that target. In boarding type operations and warning and keeping them away, a shot across the bow is probably is more appropriate by long shot. So those Bofors and the 50 cal machine guns were very effective for that type of operation. So I think it was and the 3-inch 50, which we fitted on board protector, was again in the same sort of category. It gave us a surface capability to conduct certain type operations, which the most modern ship didn't have because it was just too it was too accurate. You want to call that?
Mm-hmm.
So that was that aspect. But I think the media was interesting. They were all they were in many cases asking questions which we didn't know when we left Halifax. But I was always under the impression. And this was a policy we used in the media. Tell them everything that you can. Don't hide behind less classified. The more open you can be, the better. Let them talk to the sailors. Let them talk to the airmen. And you know they know what they can't tell. And you know, but be as open as you can, and don't hide behind classification. We did that. In fact. Throughout the war, we had media all around, media around, because they were obviously concerned about what Canadians were doing. And we had made a policy that we would put them on the ships or have them down in Doha where the aircraft were, and they could do whatever they want. We would, whenever they had the reports, they had to use our systems, particularly from the ships, to file their reports back. And we said, we will not stop any report. Mm-hmm. We will not censor any report you got. And that was a deal we made with the media, and we didn't. And we only got burnt once, and that's with an excellent reporter by the name of Paul Coring, who was doing the boarding. Was actually pretty boring itself, the boarding operations. And so he was a top line reporter, and so he wrote one article which basically talked about the morale, which on Athabasca, which we knew was not correct. It just was not correct. But he sent that, and actually had the we sent it because we said we would, and it hit the front page of the Globe and Mail, and the damage was done actually to the families in Halifax. They said, "What's going on here? What do you mean my happy? My husband's not happy, or they're not happy there." And you know, later on, I was able to call her Paul Corey, who I mentioned I had great respect for as a